Shenandoah, I love your daughter. Way, you rolling river. Oh, Shenandoah, I love your daughter. Away, we're bound away. Cross the wide Missouri.
This hour, the life and times of Pete Seeger. Anita Silvey is with us. She's the author of Let Your Voice Be Heard, and it's called the children's book, but it's really for everybody. It's a book that gives you, in a beautifully written form, the life of Pete Seeger. She says, Anita, when she read the files that the FBI had gathered about Seeger, and she studied the complete testimony of his appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee, she became angry and disturbed. How could someone who had given so much to society, someone as selfless as Seeger, be harassed and mistreated by the American government? He never grew bitter, and she was still disturbed by what happened to him in the 50s and 60s. So she offered up his story in the hope that, as a nation, we never again turn on our own citizens and do them the same kind of injustice. Anita is the author of many other books, The Essential Guide to Children's Books and Their Creators, two nonfiction titles, Henry Knox, Bookseller, Soldier, Patriot, and I'll Pass for Your Comrade, Women Soldiers in the Civil War, also the Children's Book a Day Almanac. She writes that Seeger was one of her heroes when she was a teenager. She currently teaches modern book publishing at Simmons College Graduate School of Library Science in Boston, and she and children's book author studies at St. Michael's College in Burlington, Vermont. And thank you ever so much for being with us, Anita. The book is just lovely. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show and also devoting a show to Pete. What a great thing to do on the solstice. So.
Oh, yeah, we're doing it on the solstice, aren't we?
Well, yeah.
I was going to start early in his life, but let's start with his environmental work because it's later in his life. You say at one point in the book, you know, he could have ended his career at the end of the 60s and had this full, rich contribution to all kinds of things in America, and yet he went on all the way into his 90s and became such a strong environmental activist.
Yes, I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, for the early part of his life, he's really focused on national causes, international causes. But it was when he started to look in his own neighborhood, go locally, you know, and think globally. He realized that the Hudson River was a mess, that it was just a disgusting garbage dump. And that really compelled him to think about what could they do? How could he clean up his own backyard? And he became, really, for the next 30-some years of his life, he was really a great environmental activist. And, he built the boat, the Clearwater, and sailed it down the Hudson River and kind of made it a cause for environmental cleanup. So he really did fabulous work just even in his own backyard.
Mm-hmm. He was strong, wasn't he, until the end of his days. He was a strong man.
He, in fact, on the Occupy Wall Street, he protested. You know, he was on crutches, and he was with his grandson. But he marched and in his 90s, so he never gave up.
Mm. You start the book with this very dramatic story, which I hadn't heard before. In 1949, he's driving to Peekskill, New York, to perform in a concert featuring Paul Robeson. Tell us the story.
There had been a problem with the concert before with Paul Robeson, the great African American singer, and they had postponed it, and then they brought them back. And Seeger went to perform, and then as they were, there were a lot of protesters around, and they kind of guarded the stage while it was going on. But then they all had to get in their cars and go back home. And as they went out this small, narrow driveway, suddenly there were people on both sides, and they were pelting everyone with stones. Seeger had his entire family in the car. One of his children was a baby at that point. And literally, they went for a couple of miles or so just being with a car being struck with rocks and glass coming into the car. And he eventually got out of it, and he took a couple of the stones that had fallen in the car, and he cemented them into his fireplace. He used to show reporters this all the time. And he said he just wanted to remember the incident when his life and his family's life had really been threatened, and people had stopped him from trying to sing.
Mm. And he was in so many situations in the Vietnam War protests, certainly in the labor movement, in the anti-Vietnam demonstrations, where people's lives were being threatened.
Yeah, he, you know, and certainly McCarthy era time.
Oh, yes.
You know, there were literally, you know, mobs that came around threatening his home. He was in harm's way many times. Selma, you know, he did not ever shirk from going to do the right thing because it was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had that. I think as I looked more into his life, what I realized, his life was one of somebody who did the next right thing, and whatever that would be, he had the courage to do it, and somebody else might not have had the courage.
Yes, it did take a lot of courage. Let's go back to the early life. His parents were classical musicians, but his father decided that he wanted to perform classical music for people living in rural America. This is quite a story. He just packed everybody in a car, and they drove around, huh?
That's exactly right. They put the two boys, and Pete was, I think, 15 months at that time, and they had a little trailer that they pulled behind them, and they headed down into the Appalachian area to bring classical music to those who live there. And we have beautiful posters and pictures, by the way, from the time. I'm rather glad they did, because, you know, we actually have photographic evidence of Pete as a really young child, and standing outside this car where they head off, and they cooked over open fires and you know, went through country. And of course, the interesting thing about it is that, you know, the people in Appalachia were perfectly happy with the music they already had. I mean, they already, you know, they didn't need classical music. They just started to sing for the Seegers some of the songs that they knew. So we, you know, it's quite fascinating given what Pete eventually did, because he's exposed then to authentic folk music, you know, from the time he's a small baby. I mean, he's hearing all of this stuff as they are traveling around. Eventually, Pete's mother had enough, you know, of cooking over open fires and living in a car, and they called off their sojourn, as it were, but not before, I think, their boys had had a lot of experiences, and Pete has heard already a lot of folk music.
I think you say at one point he had a lot of mentors, certainly, but he received some of his early political ideas and his ideas about taking care of people who, and understanding people and hearing their stories, people who are poverty-stricken in the country, his walks with his father through the Lower East Side of New York.
Mm-hmm. His father was a huge influence on Pete's political, sociological, you know, viewpoint. His father had actually seen migrant workers when he was out teaching in Berkeley, in California. And they came back to the East, and eventually his parents divorce, and his father goes to live in New York, and Pete will come down for visits with his father. And it's then that what his father does is, as you say, take him through walks in the Lower East Side to show him that not everybody lives with a lot of possessions, and not everybody lives in a safe community. And this grounding had an enormous impact on Pete. I mean, it took fertile soil. You know, he was born into a relatively wealthy family with a lot of privileges, but this exposure seems to have directed him to be thinking about people who didn't have every advantage that he had.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's always striking to me is what we read can really be a huge influence at various times in our lives, and you describe him as a young guy, a voracious reader, and picking up the novels of Ernest Thompson Seton on Native Americans and really admiring Native Americans to the point where he built his own teepee.
Yeah. He, a librarian in Nyack, New York, had watched what Pete was checking out, and she gave him some of the books of Seton, said, I think you might like these. And Seton, of course, was one of the founders of the Boy Scouts, but he was also the person who really believed that we should look not to the kings and queens of England as our role models, that American young people should look to the Native American people as their role models, because they shared, you know, if there was food, they all shared it, and if there wasn't food, even the chief went hungry, you know, that they had this wonderful communal style. And Pete loved this, and yes, he built teepees, he got his friends involved in building structures and living out on the land. He really, he really got excited about the message of Ernest Thompson Seton. And by the way, that was when I first talked to Pete about his love of these books. That was my first conversation.
Oh.
Yeah, it was my first conversation with him. I was doing a book called Everything I Need to Know I Learned from a Children's Book. And he, through his nephew, I got access to Pete. And he wanted to talk about the books of Seton. And I can tell you that, you know, in his late 80s, he was still wildly excited about what he'd learned from Seton. And he remembered that book. He remembered every single detail of Rolf of the Woods, the Seton book that he particularly loved. You know, I mean, he really retold me the whole story in about 45 minutes, so I knew every detail of the story. he had such an incredible memory for the things that had affected him. So Seton was that was really one of his mentors. I always love to talk about mentors, because I think none of us ever get where we are on our own. They're major figures. And so in the case of Pete, that was very easy to do, because he always, you know, paid tribute to them, which was a great thing about him.
Mm-hmm. Another was Lead Belly.
Oh, yeah. He met Lead Belly in New York. It was after he had been released from prison at that time, and was married to a very beautiful woman, and they became great friends of Seeger. And of course, he learned from them, you know, songs like The Old Cotton Field at Home, Goodnight Irene, Midnight Special. Lead Belly really passed on a whole body of folk songs to Pete while he was really young and in the city.
Mm. Let's hear a little bit of Goodnight Irene. I love this song.
Okay. Irene, goodnight. Irene, goodnight. Goodnight, Irene. Goodnight, Irene. I'll see you in my dream. Sometimes I live in the country. Sometimes I live in town. Sometimes I take a great notion to jump into the river and drown. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dreams.
Oh, it's such a wonderful song. Before we talk about where he got all of these songs, it is amazing when you listen to him, there's something about the way he sings the words, isn't it? It's not that he's a fantastic banjo player necessarily, or that his voice is absolutely gorgeous, but it's totally engaging.
It's the way he engages with the material, and the way he then engaged with audiences as well. In fact, I mean, some of his fellow musicians said exactly that. They said he wasn't the best banjo player ever. He's not the best singer we've ever had. But what he had was an ability, one, as we could hear it just in that singing, that ability to communicate what those words really mean. And also, of course, if you ever saw him in concert, the ability to get everybody in the audience singing together and enjoying the songs and becoming part of something greater, you know, a singing choir, as it were, as he performed the song. So he really is a great communicator with music. He makes it personal and he also makes it possible for people to embrace it.
When you think, Anita, and you've thought long and hard and studied him and interviewed him about what he did for a living, it's kind of remarkable that he was able to, and it was hard to make a living doing what he did, but he really didn't know for a long time where what he wanted to do, right? He wanted to be an artist, paint watercolors, a whole bunch of different things.
He had a lot of ambitions as a young man, and at first he wanted to be a journalist. That was really, he had been at Avon old school and run the newspaper, and he loved doing that. I mean, he just, you know, because he's a writer, you know, essentially, just as he will be in his music. So he thought for a while he'd be a journalist, but he couldn't get a position during the Depression, and, you know, so he had to give that up. He then decided he wanted to try art, and he traveled around and on a bicycle tour in New York, and he'd make a watercolor of somebody's farm, and then he'd give it to them and say, could I stay for the night? That didn't earn much money either, and in fact, his art teacher said to him at one point, do you do anything else besides art? And Pete said, well, I play the banjo, and the art teacher said, well, I've never heard you play the banjo, but I suggest you take that up instead. So a cruel cut.
That hurts.
That hurts, yeah. So the art career didn't look so good. But so he, through his aunt, he had a chance to play. She was at the Dalton School in New York, and he had a chance to start to play and sing for kids. And that was perfect for him. You know, it was a perfect combination, and he began to put together musical events, and eventually he is going to turn to becoming a folk singer. He's going to, you know, do that full time. So it was not the first career. It was kind of a career that he got to eventually.
Mm. And then fortuitously, he gets this job at the American Folk Song area of the Library of Congress, where he's cataloging all the treasure trove of songs, many of them he sings during his whole lifetime.
Exactly. Alan Lomax, you know, again, one of his other great mentors, who was at the Library of Congress, hires Pete to come down and just catalog, you know, record, get records of what they've brought in the folk songs that he and his father have recorded and other folk songs. So Pete is suddenly, you know, as he said, a, you know, well-paid assistant listening to all of these songs from all over America and learning what really folk songs are and what he likes in folk songs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a wonderful internship. And even more wonderful, of course, during this internship is he gets to meet the person probably who is going to have the most profound effect on him, Woody Guthrie.
A mismatched pair, you talk about them, and they were mismatched, weren't they?
They were totally, we are talking 180-degree opposites, I think, and, you know, and they ended up traveling around the country together in an old broken-down car. And, you know, Woody was wild and, you know, hard-drinking, hard-driving guy. And, you know, Pete drank milk every time they went into the bar. I mean, he's just, you know, Woody once said, Pete is the youngest person I've ever met in my life. I mean, he's just very innocent and you know, very high-minded. And they both got along and didn't get along. It was a, you know, certainly a love-hate relationship, but a tremendous admiration between them. And the great thing about Woody Guthrie for Pete is it's one thing to know the catalog of folk songs. That's, you know, that's sort of what he learned at the Library of Congress. But it's another thing to know how to perform them. And Woody was a consummate performer. And it's really on the road with Woody that Pete gets his training in how to draw out a song, how to get an audience, how to get, you know, a meal from performing, that really he learns the tricks of the performing trade from Woody while he's a young man on the road with him.
And certainly one of the big causes at that time, you write about the labor movement gaining strength during those years in the 30s. Americans had worked long hours for low wages every day of the week, no power on the job. So Woody certainly, and Pete has been known early on for taking up the cause of improving working and living conditions for workers.
Yeah, Pete there's a moment where they perform. There's a group of them from New York now calling themselves the Almanac Singers, and they go around to perform, and they perform for a union. And it's the first time that anybody's ever really responded to Pete's performing. And it's, you can really see that early on, he just, this is a great cause for him. He really understands, you know, it goes back to what his father saw in the San Joaquin Valley, what Pete saw in the Lower East Side, that somebody needs to take care of these people. And to work to get better hours and better pay for them, and someone needs to take up their cause. And so the Almanac Singers become the great, they become the kind of cheerleaders for the developing American union movement. And this is the first time that we see sort of Pete connected to a cause greater than himself,
mm-hmm.
and it really... it just energizes him in an extraordinary way. Until then, folk music had sort of been folk music. But now folk music can be tied to the cause of getting, the labor movement, the people who brought you the weekend. I mean, it can be brought to the labor, what laborers need and what people need. And it's really, this is a very exciting time in his life.
We're talking about Pete Seeger this hour with the author of a lovely book about him, Let Your Voice Be Heard, The Life and Times of Pete Seeger. It is touted as a children's book, but it's for everybody. It's all ages. It's the story of his life, all different times of his life, and he lived a good long one with involvement in the labor movement and civil rights movement, and he was in World War II. We'll talk about that, the environmental movement. Anita Sibley is our guest, and she's the author of this book. She has written a number of other books as well, The Essential Guide to Children's Books and Their Creators, other books of nonfiction, and we're welcoming your phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. We last talked about Pete Seeger, I think, when he died just a couple of years ago in his 90s and played a lot of Pete Seeger songs. What a contribution. Amazing. So we welcome your calls. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show, and we'll be weaving a lot of Pete Seeger songs in and out of our conversation. This, to give you an idea of the depth of his songs, it's just amazing all that he recorded. This is a story of a father with his magic wand and a boy with his music and how they triumph over the great Abiyoyo. It's based on a South African lullaby and folk story.
You know, once, long, long, long ago, there was a little boy. And he liked to play the ukulele. Clink, clink, clink. He was always playing the ukulele all over the place. But you know, the grown-ups say, get away, we're working here. Go off by yourself. You're getting in our way. Not only that, the boy's father was a magician. He had a little magic wand. He could go zoop, zoop, make things disappear. But the father was a practical joker. He'd come up to someone who was drinking a nice glass of something, just about to... Well, and the father goes zoop, zoop, and the glass would disappear. He'd go up to someone who was busy doing a hard job of work, maybe sawing a log of wood. Well, the father would come up, zoop, zoop, with his little wand, and the saw would disappear. He'd go up to someone that was just about to sit down, all tired out, zoop, the chair would disappear. Well, people said to the father, you get out of here too, you and your magic wand, you and your practical jokes, get out. And the boy and his father, they made him live on the edge of town. But now in this town, they used to tell stories to... They used to tell stories about the giants that used to live in the old days. They used to tell a story about a giant called Abiyoyo. Nobody believed it, but they told the stories just the same.
Lost my partner, what'll I do? Lost my partner, what'll I do? Lost my partner, what'll I do? Skip to Malou, my darling.
This hour, We're talking about Pete Seeger with the author of Let Your Voice Be Heard, The Life and Times of Pete Seeger. Anita Sylvie is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for her, 800-486-8655. And we go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. See, I've got a question for your guest about a particular song of Pete Seeger's that has always bothered me. I'm generally a fan of his, but this one has bothered me for years. It's the song Little Boxes. And if you remember the words to it, it speaks about housing, where the houses were all made out of ticky-tack and they all look the same. And it speaks very derisively, of the, as the lyrics do, of that kind of housing. And the thing is, I grew up in that kind of house. Levittown in Long Island is one type. Levittown near Philadelphia is another. And I know that the people who lived in those houses, which were kind of made out of ticky-tacky and all did look the same, those are working people. Those people who moved into those houses were probably the first in their generations that, you know, before them to own a piece of property, to have a house that was, that had a yard, instead of, being a, you know, a crammed in place in a tenement section of Philadelphia or something like that. And the people who lived there, they worked in the Fearless Hills, steel mill, right outside of Levittown, Philadelphia. They worked in factories in Philadelphia. They were truck drivers. And yet you have this song, where Pete Seeger, who, you know, is thought to be a friend of the working man and the oppressed and all that, is really speaking condescendingly of the houses that these people were just delighted to move into. And it just, it's always bugged me. I wonder where you get
that. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Anita.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. As I remember, it was his response to Levittown that, you know, he saw it, he didn't like it. And you're right, the words are quite derisive. But it's also true, as you say, he really was a union person. And, you know, I mean, Pete Seeger wrote a lot of protest, and any protester, you know, protest writer, we don't always agree with everything they say. But in the end, you know, I certainly think the body of songs that he wrote, you know, Union Made, you know, Talking Union, I mean, most of everything that Pete Seeger did during that period really is so pro-working person. So I appreciate your thoughts on the song. It's, you know, it's funny. It's not one I talked about in my book, so I guess I'm with you. It was not one that I thought was one of his best songs.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his meeting his wife, because she was very important to the Almanac Singers, the group he was with, to keeping everything moving along, right, Toshi Ota?
Oh, she was, you know, she was the working gear of the clock, as it were. She was Japanese-American, and during the time when, you know, they met during the time when we were about to go to war with Japan, and she really, again, this is another opposites attract, but during the war, she went down where Pete was based, and they got married, and she got her wedding ring, she got the, you know, papers done. I mean, clearly from the beginning, she's going to take over so much of the pragmatic life of Pete Seeger. And performers often said, you know, that one of the differences between Pete and many other performers at the time was Toshi. I mean, she was behind him for 70 years and made an enormous difference in his life.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause he was gone a lot, right?
Oh, there are some years that he is only at their home 90 days out of the year. Oof. I mean, he's just on the road continually. And, you know, that kind of travel, he even once said he felt like a boarder sometimes in his own home. And so she really had to keep everything running. At one point, she took over the management of groups. She did the management of the Weavers for a period. She kept all the tax receipts. You know, she just was the pragmatic grounding of Pete. And I think that solid marriage was so much a part of who he was as a person.
Mm. Susanna in Ossining, New York. Hi, Susanna.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really enjoying this conversation about Pete, who was someone I saw often growing up here in the Hudson Valley.
Oh.
And I wondered, I'm glad Anita spoke about Toshi. I wondered if she could share anything about His stepmother, Ruth Crawford Seeger, who I think also had an important influence on him.
Yes, you know, his father married Ruth after, you know, after divorcing Pete's mom, and she was, of course, she was another folklorist, and they had, you know, they had four children themselves, many who went into music as well. So Pete's stepfamily, as it were, you know, was a big part of his kind of upbringing, and those kind of extended that for a long time, you know, they, and I think the Seegers still do, they did extended family reunions where they all came together and played music. I did hear from people who were fortunate enough to go there that they were among the most wonderful events on the planet, you know, because you had so many talented Seegers in one room.
Mm. And Susanna, when you say that you saw him often growing up in the Hudson Valley, where did you see him?
Well, he would often show up at local festivals. Every town around here has a park on the river, and often there were festivals. He and Toshi were very active in Beacon, where they lived, founding or being part of the Sloop Club there, and they have a corn festival and a strawberry festival and another festival different times of years, and he and Toshi were always down there. He would sing, and she would make a giant pot of soup, and everyone would share in that.
Mm, that sounds lovely.
Yeah. He talked very fondly, by the way, about those festivals. He just thought they were wonderful, and, you know, everyone should attend them. So, you know, he truly enjoyed that part of time.
Thank you. I'm glad you were listening, Susanna, in the Hudson Valley. Let's talk about World War II for a moment. Did he have reservations about entering?
At first, Pete wrote protest songs about World War II. I think one was called Franklin D., You're Not Going to Send Me Over the Sea. He was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So he was, you know, he was a peace activist much of his life and didn't believe in war. But eventually the stories of what was going on with Hitler, you know, sunk in. And Woody Guthrie went away in the Merchant Marines, and he decided that, in fact, he hated Hitler, as he once said, more than he hated war. And so he, his draft notice came through. He reported for duty. And they had trouble with him because Toshi was writing to him, and she was writing to him on stationery, of the Japanese American League.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you know, and he was getting these down on in his basis. So they kept postponing sending him overseas because they weren't sure. You know, they didn't know what this alliance was. So eventually he is assigned to the division that, of course, performed for the troops. And then he went into the Pacific, and he really spent his wartime entertaining troops, getting them to sing along, doing what Pete did best, which was really, you know, to bring hope to people.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any fear that she would be in one of the Japanese internment camps in the country?
Well, I think for everybody of that time, I mean, they were on the East Coast. So, you know, I say in the book, if she had been living in the West, there would have been a good possibility that she could have gone into an internment camp. But certainly it was a troublesome, you know, time simply because of what was going on in the world and the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the time with the Weavers, probably the time and due in no small measure to Carl Sandburg, when he became, you know, a little bit wealthier guy and very well known. This group was quite popular.
Yes, well, Pete was still having trouble making ends meet. I mean, this is, you know, he's still having to rely on Toshi's family for support. They build the cabin in Beacon so that they can live a little cheaper and that their children can have a more rural environment to live in. And they have this group that they formed called the Weavers. But they, you know, Pete said they were sort of down on their luck, and they he was now taking contracts in hamburger payment per week. You know, so he would get a certain number of hamburgers to perform. So you can see that, you know, this is not, you know, this is obviously not tremendously lucrative for them. And they're just about, you know, they're just about to, they're talking about breaking up. And then Carl Sandburg comes to hear a performance, and he writes this, this beautiful review: "When I hear the Weavers, I hear America singing." And suddenly everybody's fighting to get into the club and see them, and suddenly they can go on the road and start to perform. And Decca Records, you know, seeks them out, and they begin to cut one hit song after another. And the first one was "Goodnight, Irene," and the song on the flip side was "Sena, Sena, Sena." And this is for those who never went through this period. The record had one song on one side and one song on the other. And then they went on to record things like "On Top of Old Smoky" and "Kisses Sweeter Than Wine" and "So Long It's Been Good to Know Ya." You know, these were really radical songs. That they, you know, these were very populist songs. And they went from hamburgers to, I think it was $6,000 a week, a huge amount of money in that time.
Yes.
So, yeah. So they're playing at the biggest venues, and Pete isn't altogether always that comfortable with that. You know, in fact, they say he used to protest by wearing one red sock and one green sock. You know, he'd have these little things that he would do to indicate that he wasn't totally in love with this. You know, he wasn't in love with playing at high-end venues as much as he was other kinds of venues.
Mm-hmm.
So they were really their sales, they were looking sort of like the Elvis of the 1950s.
Isn't that something?
They really could have been that sort of group. But, of course, there's trouble lurking ahead.
Absolutely. There were some FBI people looking over their shoulders, right?
Oh, yeah. J. Edgar Hoover had been interested in Pete for a very long time and had kept files on the Almanac Singers, the Weavers. And this is right, of course, when we move into the McCarthy era, and Counterattack was published of communists in the entertainment industry. And Pete is mentioned, and the Weavers are mentioned in that article. And then somebody who gave false witness against them is kind of commandeered by McCarthy, and he goes before the House of Un-American Activities and said, oh, yeah, they're communists, and, you know, they should be stopped. So suddenly the fame starts to go the other way again.
Mm-hmm. He had been a member of the Communist Party, and I believe you say in the book that he wishes that he had left earlier than he did. He was just
busy. Yeah, I spent a lot of time talking to him about that because I wanted to make sure that I got that very clear, you know, like when was he in, when did he leave. And his father became a member of the CPA, and his father left in the early 1940s. And what Pete said later was, he said, that's when I should have left too. My father told me that communism in theory was not what was going on in the Soviet Union. You know, that there were terrible things happening in the Soviet Union, and I would not support that, Russia, you know, what was happening in Russia. But he said, I didn't pay attention. I was a performer. I was on the road. And then, of course, he's in the war, and we're the allies with Russia during the war. And so it really was, in the date he always gave was early in 1949. He realized that this was not his political position anymore, and he didn't support what was going on there, and he left and had nothing more to do with it. So he had once been a communist, but by the time the McCarthy era comes around, he is no longer involved in the Communist Party at all.
Let's go to more phone calls. A number of people want to speak about him and to you. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. I was becoming of age as an early teenager when "Goodnight, Irene" was number one. And I had an aunt, Irene, and uncles who liked to sing and play guitars, and that song was sung. I mean, I could hear it sung, especially during the holidays. I think it was number one during the Christmas season, some year in the early 50s. That song sure burned into my memory. And then the night would end with "So Long It's," I mean, with the good, it was kind of a good night song, "So Long It's Good to Know You." Hmm. But here was a person that made everybody sing, you know, rather than argue. and then I found out, you know, that Congress could do strange things. I mean, could shut you up. You know, he was silent for a long time after coming before the House Un-American Committee or Un-American Activity Committee. And that's my story, Pete. I'll never forget Pete.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, it's a 10-year struggle for him. It's going to be from 1952 to 1962. He's finally cleared of all charges. So, you know, it means lawyers and all kinds of things. He's still going to keep performing, by the way, but he has to go underground. He really starts going to summer camps and schools and college campuses, and, you know, he has to kind of take a different venue because he really can't do he can't perform on television, he can't perform other places. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I love your line that, you know, this was somebody that made everybody get along. I just think that's kind of the essence of what Pete Seeger wanted to be about.
Absolutely. He tried, what song did he sing? They wouldn't let him sing it, the HUAC committee, but he sang it to reporters outside the hearing.
Yeah, the song wasn't that a time. Our fathers bled at Valley Forge, and that was his. You know, it was one of the songs that he wrote. Some of it was the song he wrote about some of his ancestors because he, you know, came from Mayflower ancestors, and they wouldn't let him. He brought his banjo to the House of Un-American Activities, but they didn't want to hear him sing. He just basically said, "I'm a singer. That's all I do. I love this country. You know, I sing good songs. I think good songs can bring us together. Would you like to hear one of my good songs?" You know, I mean, he was. And they were not amused. Yeah, I'm afraid that no, there were no laughs that day.
I'll bet there weren't.
Yeah, they found him in contempt of Congress, actually. But, you know, his manager said that's a, you know, it's kind of a lousy way to get a song on the radio, you know.
Our guest this hour is the author of Let Your Voice Be Heard, The Life and Times of Pete Seeger, Anita Silvey. Our phone number, Kenneth, thanks for your call, is 800-486-8655. This song, we're playing some of his music during the hour because we'll let him sing by recording. This song you'll be familiar with. It's amazing. We know all these songs. You know the words to most of them. This song was written in 1931 by Florence Reese, the wife of Sam Reese, a union organizer for the United Mine Workers in Harlan County, Kentucky. The miners and the mine owners of that region were locked in a bitter and violent struggle. Here's Pete Seeger.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on?
And let's go back to phone calls. Let's go to Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I have three quick things. First of all, I wonder how he would feel about this Trump election. Second of all, has he ever been inducted into, like, a musical hall of fame, rock and roll, or something like that? And has anybody ever made a movie about his life? I think this would be a great subject for a Michael Moore movie.
Well, yeah, for a movie would be. His grandson made a wonderful PBS Masters special called Pete Seeger, The Power of Song. And if anyone's never seen that, that's just a great introduction to his life. And I think it's a few years ago he was induced into the Hall of Fame, which is a lovely thing. And actually at the time right before he died, people were very actively trying to get a Nobel Peace Prize for him,
mm-hmm.
Something that I would have loved to have seen, I must admit. So he had a lot of awards and accolades, Grammys and all of that. But, yeah, I would agree with you that Pete Seeger is a great would be a great candidate for a movie, and I have no doubt that he'd be writing some protest songs right now, or he may be in the great music all in the sky. So I would think this would be a time. He always used to say that difficult times brought out the poet in him and the writer in him and the best in him, and that he was somebody who could face things that other people might think are too dark, and he had no trouble walking into them and becoming creative and using art, you know, to bring them around. Mm. So that's my guess of what he'd be doing now.
Well, let's talk about one of those dark times and hear a song that, at least since the 60s, so many people have taken this up, and it's become a very important song for so many movements. He was part of the Mississippi Summer Project in 64, performing in Meridian, Mississippi, when word came that the bodies of three project workers had been found buried in a dam, and he led an audience in this song. And he changed the title, too. Let's listen to this, and it's just been so widely sung for so many movements ever since.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall.
Just imagining him singing this song to people who must have been weeping and frightened at the same time in Meridian, Mississippi.
Yes, and finding comfort in it, and you know, the truth. He added verses to this: "The truth shall set us free." You know, just a song that kind of pulled an audience together and brought them together. And you know, again, it's "We shall overcome." It's that sense of a group can accomplish what an individual can't. He heard that song the first in around 1947, and he was at the Highlander School. And there's a beautiful photo, by the way, of Pete and Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and Reverend Abernathy, you know, at the Highlander School. It was a working song in the fields, and it was "We Will Overcome" in the original version that he heard. And he always said he liked "Shall" better because he said it sort of opened up the vocal cords. And, you know, and he said, "Yeah, and it's my New England grammar. You know, I can't get away from it." You know, that. So he changed it a bit, added you know, verses to it. And of course, it was Martin Luther King's. You know, when he heard it, it was really became his favorite song. And as we know, it is, you know, became the anthem of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, it sure did. We've had several listeners call in about Little Boxes. This one from Luann in Green Bay. Malvina Reynolds wrote Little Boxes. I remember that now. The point was people not being able to see anything different from their own little boxes, not being able to see outside the box. I get that, but I can also see what Bill was saying, too, that, you know.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
that it was insulting to the people who lived in those homes.
Exactly.
I think was what Bill was saying, that they were poor people, too. So it was a little different take on that song, I thought.
Yeah. Joey in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hi, Joey.
Hi. I'm just really enjoying this show. One time, in high school, I was a huge fan of Pete Seeger's. I would quote him to everyone in high school. So one time I decided to write him a letter. So I sent the letter out to him, and I waited for about 2 to 3 months. My parents told me to give up all hope. And then the week before Christmas, he actually sent a postcard to me, handwritten, telling me I had asked about Phil Oakes, what the civil rights movement was like. And he actually took time out of his schedule to write to me. And 3 or 4 years ago, for his 94th birthday, I went to New York to go celebrate it with him. And I was walking the streets in New York, and I turned my head, and there he was right in front of me. But I was so starstruck, I couldn't find myself to say anything to him. So I just took a picture of his back, and sadly, a few months later, he was gone.
Oh. Thank you so much for your call. His voice is in front of us. And Anita, thanks for the book. It's terrific. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks. And thanks for celebrating Pete today.
Absolutely.
Just a joy.
Anita Sylvie, our guest, and the book is Let Your Voice Be Heard, The Life and Times of Pete Seeger. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this show. And thanks to you, Pete Seeger.